Welcome to the ISGO podcast with Dr. Dearan O'Leary. My name is Dr. Dervla Collins. I'm a medical oncologist and I'm president of ISGO, the Irish Society of Gynecological Oncology. Our aim is to advocate for patients through improvements in education, training and research. And the purpose of this podcast is to highlight the lived experience of patients undergoing gynecological treatments, combining the evidence with patient stories. We hope this will serve as a support to patients as well as those working in the area. We are very grateful to our sponsors, Breakthrough Cancer Research, Ireland's leading research charity for poor prognosis cancers. Breakthrough Cancer Research supports research all over Ireland in gynecological cancers.
Welcome back to the ISGO podcast. In today's episode, we're going to discuss gestational trophoblastic disease with Dr. John Coulter, who is a consultant gynecologist and obstetrician at CUMH. And we'll also chat with patient advocate Rachel. Good morning.
Good morning, Dearan.
Dr. Coulter, thank you so much for being here this morning. So gestational trophoblastic disease, it's really fascinating. And you're the clinical lead of the centre in CUMH. But I don't think a lot of people really would have heard about this unless they were directly affected by it. So what is it? What is gestational
trophoblastic disease? Yeah, it's a rare disease that you have to be or have to have been pregnant to get. The commonest presentation is something we call a molar pregnancy, which occurs in about 1 in 600 pregnancies here in Ireland. So it's quite rare, but it does happen. We do see about maybe 120 to 150 cases a year in Ireland. What tends to happen is that, unfortunately, the genetics go wrong at conception is probably the easiest way to describe it, in that there are two types of molar pregnancies that we deal with, a complete molar pregnancy or a partial molar pregnancy. In a complete molar pregnancy, for some reason, the genetic material is absent from the mother's egg, which means this is probably more likely in teenage years with premature oocytes or eggs, or in women in later reproductive life, maybe late 30s and early 40s, where you've got perhaps some post-mature eggs. So for some reason, the genetic material is either inactivated or completely lost. That's fertilized by a sperm, but there are 23 chromosomes then in the conceptus, and there should be 46. Mm. Nature knows that there should be 46. So it duplicates what's in the conception. But of course, all of the genetic material is from dad. Mm. There is no input from mom, so a baby never grows, but dad's genes code for development of the placenta, so a very abnormal placenta is produced. And of course, nobody knows this is going on, and mom feels pregnant, and the HCG, or the pregnancy hormone, levels are rising as they normally would. But this abnormal placenta has the ability to invade the muscle of the uterus and even spread outside the uterus. Mm. So these very often present as bleeding in the first trimester, and there's a risk that there might be a miscarriage. This woman has an ultrasound, and very often on an ultrasound you can see the very abnormal placenta, and that's our suspicion that there might be a complete molar pregnancy present. So that normally is an abnormal pregnancy, and we know there's a risk of the cells leaving the uterus and going around the body in some particular cases. Yeah. So usually the treatment for that is to remove the abnormal tissue from the uterus, called an evacuation retained products of conception, or a DNC in layman's terms. Yeah. The partial molar pregnancy is a little bit different in that there is genetic material from mum, and usually the egg is fertilized by two sperm. So you've got 69 chromosomes instead of 46, and the extra one is paternal. And in those situations, there can be fetal tissue, but very often these end up as miscarriage. Now, the difficulty with the molar pregnancies is that, especially in the complete molar pregnancy, even after the abnormal tissue is evacuated from the uterus, we continue to follow up those women's blood HCG or pregnancy hormone levels.
Yeah.
Because there's about a 12 to 15% chance that this woman will not normalize her HCG. In other words, those cells will persist.
Yeah.
Either in the uterus or can spread around the body,
yeah,
and she may need chemotherapy,
yeah,
to fix it. So the difficulty for those women is that, number one, unfortunately, you lose your pregnancy. Mm. Number two, you're now diagnosed with a disease that needs follow-up. And thankfully, in 85% of complete molar pregnancies And in 98% of partial motor pregnancies, the HCG levels come down to normal by themselves and no further treatment is needed. But in 12 to 15% of the complete moles and 1 to 2% of the partial moles, they now need chemotherapy as well. So the difficulty is, especially when women are diagnosed with this disease, firstly, of course, they're going to Google it and they're going to look for what does all this mean? And of course, a lot of these women then think, jeepers, maybe I'm developing a cancer for what should have been hopefully a normal pregnancy. So for many years in Ireland, the management of these women has been inconsistent. It is so rare that you wouldn't expect many obstetricians and gynecologists to come across it regularly. So the inconsistent management has been, I suppose, a lack of expertise and a lack of experience in a lot of quarters around the country. So I was training in Australia and we used to manage our own trophoblastic disease in the oncology unit where I trained. So when I came back to Ireland, I developed an interest in it and started managing a lot of the patients around Cork. And then as part of the National Cancer Control Program back in 2013, 2014, we decided at the clinical leads meetings that rare tumours should be managed by perhaps one centre in such a small country as ours. So I put my hand up and said, look, gestational trophoblastic disease is one of these rare tumours that should probably be managed in one centre. And from there, we got a group together, a multidisciplinary group who had a special interest. We developed our national guidelines. We then managed to get funding from the HSE. And then we set up our national centre and went live in 2017 for that very reason, so that every woman in Ireland who was registered with us with a molar pregnancy or trophoblastic disease would be managed by a team, I suppose, that had developed expertise and experience in managing the disease.
Yeah, so fascinating. So you have a centre of excellence there and patients from all over the country can be treated, or even you can give advice remotely to colleagues.
Yeah. What we tend to do is that every woman in the country who's diagnosed with trophoblastic disease, as I said, mostly molar pregnancies, but there are non-molar gestational trophoblastic diseases as well, in that a woman who has had a pregnancy in the past, unfortunately, many years later can develop trophoblastic disease as well. So it's not always during the index pregnancy. But what we've done is that we've developed a system whereby any of these women can be registered with us and referred to us by their treating obstetrician, gynecologist or oncologist. And once this patient is registered with us, we have three clinical nurse specialists who contact the patient immediately and spend about 30 minutes to 60 minutes on the phone counselling them as to what exactly this is and what it means and what the follow-up will be like, so they get the right information from the right people. And then we decide with the patient where she's going to have her weekly HCG blood tests done. We contact the biochemistry laboratory and we have excellent communication with all of our biochemists around the country who deal with this. So we go looking for the HCG result every week and the biochemistry labs know that we're going to be looking for it. So every week we get the result back. Our clinical nurse specialists phone the patient with her HCG result and also then has the opportunity to discuss the implications of that result with them. You know, and thankfully in the vast majority, the results are coming down appropriately. So that's all very reassuring. But sometimes they don't come down, they plateau or they rise over a number of weeks. And that's where we really kick into action, I suppose, in deciding how and where and in what respect these women need chemotherapy treatment. So that's how we run it. We run it as a virtual centre for everyone who is registered with us, but we make personal contact with each patient on a weekly basis with their results.
You know, and the importance of that, you know, that clinical nurse specialist who is familiar with this, who can talk to the patients and give them that support and the correct information, because it is such a rare disease process, you know.
Yeah, that's true, because in a lot of countries around the world, women just get maybe a letter to say your current HCG result is satisfactory, please send us back another one in 2 weeks or a week or whatever. We're very lucky in that we have the availability of our clinical nurse specialists who know all the patients and phone the patients. So the patient feedback to us would let you know that they feel very minded by our clinical nurse specialists. They get to know them very well. and they really feel that they've got a team that's on top of this. And,
yeah.
You know, they feel like we've got their back.
Yeah.
You know, so the ability to talk to the clinical nurse specialist, and they even, you know, sometimes they'll phone our clinical nurse specialist if they have an issue or if they have more questions. It's not all about waiting for the HCG results. They have very easy access, you know.
Yes.
So it makes such a difference. And if you look at the cards and the feedback that the nurses have got over the number of years, it's just incredible how special they are to the patients. And they, as I said, they really mind the patients, and the patients really, really, really appreciate
that. Yeah, I mean, you know, cancer nurse specialists, you know, across the spectrum of cancers, and clinical nurse specialists in general, you know, there's such a lovely support to patients, because you do, you think of the questions late at night, long after the phone call or the consultation, so you can phone your clinical nurse specialist and, you know, ask those questions. So they're absolutely amazing and particularly important in something like this, because patients will probably feel like they can't really talk to anyone. They can't talk to their friends. Friends don't know what it is about.
Sure.
Family. Yeah. It's so isolating. So they can talk to someone who is giving them the correct information, you know, kind of like counselling them almost as well.
Sure, yeah. Because as I mentioned earlier, if you Google it, like any cancer specialty, if you Google something, you're going to just wind yourself up, you know, to 11 out of 10, because what you read, you think is going to be you, even though it's got nothing to do with you.
Yeah.
You know, so these women are getting the right information
from the right people. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, the clinical nurse specialists are the ones who really run the service from day to day.
Yeah.
I'm there in the background. I'm making important clinical decisions.
Yeah.
But the fact that the vast majority of women will normalize themselves.
Yeah.
Without input or need from me, it's great. And they can just be managed by the clinical nurse specialists, who know that I'm on the end of the phone or in the office almost every day to ask questions of. What I suppose where my real role comes in as an oncologist is when things start to go wrong and the HCG levels don't come down to normal.
Yes.
And we need to make decisions, as I said, as to what type of chemotherapy and where and by whom, for what reason, when that needs to be diagnosed and managed.
Okay. So, you know, a lot of the time when we're thinking about cancers, we talk about cancers, we think of staging scans. Do you need to do that as well with this? You know, if the HCG isn't coming down?
Yeah, if the HCG isn't coming down. I mean, we don't look at one abnormal result as being indicative of needing treatment. We look for a trend over 2 to 3 weeks. So if we've got two HCG levels that have risen, or three plateaus where it hasn't reduced by 10%, then we know that, unfortunately, this woman might be getting into a bit of trouble. So what I'll do at that stage is, of course, if your HCG is going up, one of the first things we need to figure out is this a new pregnancy? Because we do advise every woman as part of their follow-up that it's very important that they don't become pregnant, because if they do during their follow-up, and follow-up may be 6 or 9 months for a complete molar pregnancy, if the HCG levels start to rise, we don't necessarily know whether it's due to a new pregnancy or whether this is recurrence or persistence of the disease. So the first thing we'll always do is get an ultrasound to make sure this isn't a new pregnancy. And on rare occasions, it is.
Okay.
But if it isn't, the next thing we do is we go looking for where the cells might be.
Mm-hmm.
So we will normally do a CT scan of thorax, abdomen and pelvis, because there's a special worldwide staging system or scoring system that we use that looks at 8 different things. It looks at the age of the woman. It looks at the type of pregnancy that's led to this current problem. It looks at the HCG levels, and it looks at the length of time it's taken for the HCG from the start to become abnormal. In other words, not responding properly. Then we look the site, size and number of spread areas, and whether she's had previous chemotherapy before. So that's really where I come in.
Yeah.
To do this worldwide scoring system that we use. So we decide based on a certain level as to whether, because once this happens, this woman unfortunately needs chemotherapy, full stop.
Okay, yeah.
This disease is not going away by itself. The decision is made, she needs chemotherapy. So the scoring system allows us to determine, can we give her the easiest type of chemotherapy or does she need something stronger? And the easiest type would be something called methotrexate, which we give as an injection.
Okay.
So she has 4 injections, 2 days apart. So week on, week off, week on, week off, week on, week off. So a score of 6 or less, and I don't need to go into detail about how we find that score of 6. But the less disease is present, the more likely she is to respond to the single agent injections, okay, methotrexate. Yeah. However, if her score is greater than 6, we know that she is less likely to respond to single agent methotrexate. So there's no point in starting with that.
Okay.
And we start with more combination chemotherapy, which is more like the regular chemotherapy mm-hmm. you'd hear of for, say, yeah. something like ovarian cancer or yes. other cancers. So that's obviously a bigger jump.
Yeah.
But what it means is that our aim is cure.
Mm-hmm.
And thankfully, we cure about 98 to 99% of women
yeah.
worldwide with trophoblastic disease.
Yeah.
Whatever their score.
Okay.
The success rates are excellent, given the premise that they are treated by the right people in the right
yes.
centers with expertise.
Okay.
Yeah. So the success rate and survival rate is superb.
Okay.
Even if we have to use multi-agent chemotherapy. It would be lovely to use just a single agent if we could, but there are a number of women, unfortunately, who do require multi-agent or combination chemotherapy.
Okay. Yeah,
but the aim is cure.
Yeah, that's an uplifting message. You know, the aim is cure and the cure rates are so high, you know, so that's a good message. So those are the treatment options. What about follow-up then? So once you say if a woman has been through her treatment,
yeah,
does she need follow-up?
She does. And a lot of women will ask, how long do you think the treatment is going to go on for?
Yeah.
And the answer is we don't know until we actually give her the treatment.
Okay.
So our usual answer is as long as it takes. Someone may have only required maybe 3 or 4 cycles of chemotherapy. Others have required 10 or 12. When the HCG comes down to normal, they get 3 consolidation courses, which is
okay.
an extra 6 weeks, like week on, week off. So mm-hmm. an extra 6 weeks of treatment. And that can be difficult for women, especially in their late 30s, or early 40s. And this may have been their first pregnancy.
Yeah.
And they may not have a child at this stage. And
yeah.
of course, it's very important to them to try to get back to their fertility. But
yeah.
once they finish the chemotherapy, we need to follow them up for at least a year.
Okay.
And our advice is that they do not become pregnant in that year, because there's a 4 to 8% risk of recurrence of the disease, which mm. may require further chemotherapy.
Yeah.
So once again, it's very heartbreaking for them to have to wait that extra year. But as I say to them, look, we put our oncology blinkers on.
Yep.
You
yep.
know, our aim is cure.
Safety first.
Safety first. And your fertility to us
yeah.
trying to cure you
yeah.
is the optional extra, even though we want you to get back to us
yep.
as quickly as we can. So once they've completed their follow-up, the success rates for pregnancies also are superb.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is great. Even after multi-agent chemotherapy, we've had a number of women, even here in Cork and in Ireland,
yeah.
who become pregnant.
Yes.
And have had successful pregnancies afterwards. I suppose the only disadvantage of needing multi-agent chemotherapy to date that we know of in the international literature is that it is likely to bring menopause forward by an average of 3 years.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, but it doesn't appear to affect fertility, which is great.
Really interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so your fertility will go back to like the baseline, what it was going to be anyway.
Yes, I suppose age-related.
Yes,
because,
yeah.
of course, if you have a woman, say, who's 40, who
yeah.
has some older pregnancy, and maybe 3 or 4 months later she needs chemotherapy, and that goes on for maybe 5
yeah.
or 6 months, and then another year, she's now 42 or 43.
Yeah.
So, of course, our fertility rate, yes, will be age related.
Yeah.
But, you know, and unfortunately, that's our fault that she
yeah.
has to have
yeah.
avoided
the treatment.
That pregnancy for a year or two.
Yeah, I can imagine how difficult that is for patients, because all of the messaging around fertility and getting pregnant is, you know, it's your age, maternal age. And, you know, every month, every 6 months is so huge to women
yeah.
in that mindset. But like you said, you know, it's kind of, it's like, you know, that life versus limb thing. It's,
it
like,
is.
Know.
And back in the 70s, there was a paper published in the Irish Medical Journal that the mortality
yeah.
from choriocarcinoma, which is one of the rare but aggressive forms of trophoblastic disease, was 40% in Ireland back in the 70s.
Wow.
Yeah. And since then, a number
Gosh.
Of women have had to go to London, like Charing Cross Hospital in London, and there, Trophoblastic Disease Centre, a lot of us would consider as one of the top centres in the world.
Yeah.
A number of Irish people would have had to travel to London
yeah.
for their treatment. So if you consider that the mortality rate was that high in the
70s, yeah.
and now it's only 1% to 2%,
yeah.
you know, so we've really made great strides.
Yeah.
And as you say, for these women who are at a young age, mm. you know, with so many, you know, years ahead of them, to be able to offer such a high cure rate is great. And as you say, it's, I suppose that's our aim.
Yeah.
And if fertility, you know, comes afterwards, fabulous.
Yes.
Yeah. If it doesn't, at least we've done better than they were doing many years ago.
Absolutely.
A lot better.
Yeah, there must be so much job satisfaction from that, you know, to, you know, with such a high a cure rate. What about risk of recurrence if a woman has had a partial or a complete molar pregnancy and then she's cured from whatever treatment she had? Mm-hmm. Is there a risk of a recurrence?
Yeah, thankfully the risk is very small.
Okay.
It's only about 1%.
Okay.
If you've had a molar pregnancy before, the risk of a recurrence is only about 1%.
Okay.
Which is great. So what we normally do is we encourage women to have maybe an early ultrasound for any future pregnancy. Not just the next one, any future pregnancy. Mm. At about maybe 6 or 7 weeks, just to ensure that hopefully there's a normal little fetus there and there's normal pregnancy ensuing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's very rare, thankfully. Yeah. Mm. And, you know, the rate of miscarriage doesn't go up when you've had a previous molar pregnancy. The risk of congenital anomalies doesn't go up when you've had a previous molar pregnancy, even if you'd needed chemotherapy. So it's very reassuring that the risk of recurrence is very small. Now, there are some families who have a genetic mutation, but that's incredibly rare, like other cancers.
Yes.
You know, there are genetic mutations we know in ovarian cancer, bowel cancer, breast cancer, other cancers as well. But there's a very rare genetic mutation that predisposes women to molar pregnancies as well, but that's incredibly rare, thankfully.
Okay, that's really interesting. I think this is a really fascinating discussion because even for me as a GP, or even as a medical student, I think I didn't have a full, you know, I didn't have as in-depth an understanding of it as this. And then as a GP, I've seen it once. I've had one patient and she went on to have a normal pregnancy, a baby afterwards. So I've just seen it once and I might never see it again, you know. It's so rare.
You know, what we tend to do is that when the patient is registered with us, we will send a letter to the patient confirming it, of course. Because they give written consent on the registration form. That's very important because we hold their data and also blood samples, etc. And they also give us consent to contact them in the future for future research, for example. If we come up with, you know, a new genetic marker or something. It is rare and I suppose a lot of people don't know about it.
Mm.
So we'll also write to the GP.
Yeah.
But we don't, you know, we give information that, look, this is what we're doing. This is why we will probably only need to contact you again if she's either discharged because she's normalized her follow-up or if there's an issue and she needs chemotherapy. So normally what we do is, I mean, this is a multidisciplinary team approach.
Yeah.
You know, our biochemists are fabulous, pathologists, radiologists, you know, our gynecologists, our clinical nurse specialists, and we're under the umbrella of the National Cancer Control Program as well as the HCC. So there's a lot of information on our website because we do have a website.
Okay.
And if you were just to Google Molar Pregnancy Ireland or Molar Pregnancy Cork, just a regular Google.
Okay.
Molar Pregnancy Cork, the first website that comes up is ours.
Okay.
So on the website, we've information for clinicians.
Okay.
As well as information for patients. Now, our clinical nurse specialist will send out a lot of leaflets and information to the patients as well as talking to them.
Yeah.
But for the other healthcare professionals, all you got to do is just Google Molar Pregnancy Ireland or Molar Pregnancy Cork. You get onto our website and there's a lot of information for clinicians, even tutorials on how to explain a complete molar pregnancy and a partial molar pregnancy to a patient. I've put all of that on our website.
Lovely. Right, I've got some homework to do. So, is there anything we missed from today? Anything else you think we need to touch on? I think we got through everything. It's very interesting.
Yeah, I think one of the issues we have had is with regard to some of our patients needing to get time off to come for their weekly blood tests and childcare and accessing where they get the blood tests done.
Yeah.
It can be difficult sometimes to get into their GP. And of course, it can be difficult for them to come back to our early pregnancy unit in Cork University Maternity Hospital or whichever early pregnancy unit around the country. Because of course, you're going to be walking into the maternity hospital where there are pregnant women all around you. And that can be upsetting to many women. So thankfully in Cork, we're lucky in that St. Catherine's, which is behind CUMH complex, now has phlebotomy there. So our patients, thankfully, can make their own appointment and don't have to come back into the hospital. But one of the most important things for us is that our clinical nurse specialists know where every woman is having her blood tests done, and we know every biochemistry lab that those blood tests will be going to. So there is a lead biochemist and a lead scientist in each lab that knows that we'll be phoning for the result all the time.
Yeah.
So that's a nice innovation that women don't necessarily have to come back to the hospital, but we understand that it can be difficult.
Yeah.
Sometimes they need to pay a childminder.
Yeah.
You know, to be able to come for their blood tests. But I suppose to us, it is just so important that they're managed appropriately with such high cure rates.
The logistics of it, because it's very easy for us, you know, to chat here back and forth and, you know, you need a blood test every week or every 2 weeks. But as you say, even getting time off, you know, at work, and you might not want to disclose that to an employer, you know.
Yeah,
empathy for patients.
And that's, I suppose that's where our clinical governance comes in and helps as well, because we have meetings 4 times a year under the umbrella with the National Cancer Control Programme. So we do have clinical governance meetings, and we can bring up the feedback we get from the patients, for example. You know, sometimes we mightn't know necessarily that someone has to pay to go and have their blood test done.
Yeah.
And we get feedback about that. So we can ask the NCCP at our clinical governance meetings to help us address that.
Yes.
You know, with the Women's and Infants Programme, for example, or the ability to go to a different place and have the blood test done. So that's also a great backup to us.
Yeah.
So that, in other words, where do we go if we see that there are issues arising that the patients feed back to us?
Yeah.
You know, so at least we have that backup that we can escalate our issues that we've got from the patients to them and help to get a solution to that.
Yeah, it's lovely. So it's a really patient-centered service that you're offering.
Sure, yeah.
Thank you so much. That was so interesting.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
So now we're joined by Rachel, who is a patient who has experienced a molar pregnancy herself. Rachel, can you tell us about your story?
Yeah, so back in 2019, I had a molar pregnancy. When I was pregnant at 8 weeks, I started to bleed and I went to the emergency department, and I was booked in then with the early pregnancy unit. And then when I went to the early pregnancy unit the following week, you know, I knew straight away something was wrong, because the consultant came in straight away and they explained to me that it was a molar pregnancy. They knew on the screen it was like a snowstorm in the womb. Like, so they knew that it was straight away that it was a molar pregnancy. And on that day, my HCG, which is your pregnancy hormone, was 400,000, which is like extremely high. So they kind of said, look, this is really a priority. We need to kind of do a D&C today. So that happened on the day. And then they explained everything to me about molar pregnancy and the follow-up. And they did touch on, you know, maybe that, you know, if you could need further treatment. But at that stage, I was just more concerned about what had just happened, and I wasn't pregnant any longer. So I went done the follow up where I would go and get my bloods. So the following week I went, and my bloods had dropped completely down to 720. So that meant obviously the D&C had worked, and they were quite happy with them results. The following week I went back and they had gone up to 1900. So they knew that maybe not all the cells were caught with the D&C. So it was actually around Christmas time, and they had booked me in. I was actually going to London for the weekend, and they had said, right, come back in after the weekend and we'll do some tests and see what's going on. So when I was actually in London, I actually started to hemorrhage when I was there, and I had to go to the emergency department over there, which was so frightening. I thought, like, God, I'm dying here. Like, what's going on? It was brilliant. The hospital in London were brilliant. They actually booked me in with the early pregnancy unit the next day there. And they kind of could see from the scan that, look, yeah, there is something kind of cells growing there again in the womb. And they said, look, it's probably best you go back to Ireland. Like, that's where all your care is. They know all your history. So I flew home, and the next day I went to the kiln, and they done all the tests. And obviously my HCG then was gone up. I think it was 47,000 that day. So it was going rapidly up. So they knew, look, this is actually, you know, you're going to need to have some treatment. The D&C, if they done another D&C, it wouldn't work. And Yeah, basically, I was transferred that day from the Coombe to St James's Hospital to the oncology ward, where I met all my doctors that day and they explained what would happen. And I started treatment. So I done metrotectal, can't even say that word, sorry, injections. So which is basically a form of chemotherapy, where you get injections into your kind of the side of your hip, kind of. So that's the treatment that I was on. So I had to spend 3 weeks in hospital. So it was New Year's Eve the day I went in. And I was there for pretty much the whole month of January 2020, because I had hemorrhaged so much in London. They were afraid that it would happen again and the treatment would probably bring that on. So it was a very scary time. I was on an oncology ward for 3 weeks with lots of people who were very, very sick with different forms of cancer. A lot of older people. I was probably one of the youngest people that was there on the ward. And yeah, so I suppose I done the treatment from January to June. And when you reach zero with your HCG, you have to do 3 precautional rounds. And it's to make sure that, like, obviously they've killed all the cells and that nothing has kind of, that won't come back. So I finished in June 2020. So obviously COVID had came into the mix kind of towards the middle and the end of the treatment. So it was very different experience going to the hospitals during that time. Thankfully, I wasn't staying in overnight, which was good, because when I was in hospital, I had a lot of family and friends supporting me, which was really good. So then once I finished my treatment, you do a year follow up. So I was doing every kind of bloods every 2 weeks. Then it went to every month after 6 months. And then the following April 2021, my HCG result had gone up, which was very unusual to happen. So straight away, the midwives in the Mohler Clinic in Cork rang me to say, are you pregnant? And I said, no, I don't think so. And in fairness, St. James's were on to me as well. And they brought me in to do tests. I wasn't pregnant, but the HCG was rising very slightly. You know, it was like 20, like really low at that stage. But they were concerned because your HCG shouldn't be rising if you're not pregnant. So therefore, I had to do lots of, got an MRI, a CAT scan, PET scan, you name it, ultra scan, everything I was getting to see was there any cells in the body. They couldn't find any cells anywhere, but obviously because the bloods were rising, they knew that there's something, some type of cell somewhere in my body. And obviously there has been cases in the past where this has happened, even though it's very, very rare. So I suppose Dr. Coulter and the team in St. James's were working together. They also were onto a consultant in London who is a professional in the area. And I suppose the advice was that I would do more treatment to make sure that the cell, wherever it is completely gone and that it doesn't come back. So I had to start treatment again then in August 2021. Unfortunately, this time the treatment had to be more intense chemotherapy treatment because they couldn't use the same one. So yeah, it was very was a lot more challenging. That time I lost all my hair. I had to, you know, inject myself with different blood thinners and different stuff. So it was much more extreme treatment and recovery as well. So I only needed to have 5 rounds. I had 2 rounds and my HCG was 0. But again, I had to do 3 precautional rounds. So I had 5 rounds in total and I finished in October 2021. And then I had to do the year follow up. And thankfully that went by and the HCG said undetected. So I'm 2 years now, obviously, since that has happened. And I suppose the good news is that I'm 17 weeks pregnant now with a healthy pregnancy. And so fingers crossed the rest of it continues that way. So, yeah, it's been a long journey. It's been 4 years, you know, but it's something that you never think would happen to you. Like, I never even knew what a Mohler pregnancy was. I'd never heard of it. Most people that I say it to, or like my family and friends, were like, what is this? Never heard of it. Even in the hospitals, you know, an awful lot of doctors and nurses, they don't know what it is either. It's very rare to happen and just very unfortunate. So, yeah, so that's kind of a quick snapshot of kind of my story.
Thanks so much, Rachel, for sharing your story. And, you know, you summarized it there so quickly, but that was a very long, difficult 4 years for you, you know, or from that moment, you know, you think you're pregnant and then being diagnosed with a Mohler pregnancy. And like you said, you'd never heard of this before. You know, most people haven't. And even, you know, as you say, like, you know, doctors are unfamiliar with it. A lot of people haven't heard of it, you know, and you've been through so much. And it's so lovely now to hear that you're 17 weeks pregnant. You know, congratulations. That's such a lovely way for you to summarize your story this morning. That road was obviously very, very difficult. What would you say was the hardest part of it all for you?
I think the hardest probably part is that it's a form of cancer, you know, that kind of way. And you just wanted to have a baby. And then now you're like on talking to oncology doctors and you're on an oncology ward and you're faced with the cancer kind of thing, you know, that way, which is very scary. Particularly like I was young, you know, that way, and just people dying in the hospital. And it's just, that was probably the hardest kind of piece. You don't realize that a pregnancy can actually lead to something like that. And so that was probably the really hardest piece, was being thrown into that side of stuff when, you know, you were pregnant, you weren't expecting then to be in hospital and being in oncology ward and, you know, getting treatment and stuff like that. So it's just, yeah, that was probably one of the hardest things to kind of go through. And when, particularly because I had to stay overnight in the hospital, that was very challenging.
Yeah. As you say, you know, it was the last thing that you had expected, you know, for that next phase of your life. What were things you used to cope during that time? You know, was there anything that you did that helped you through that time?
Yeah, I suppose I had a great kind of, a lot of family and friends, so I had a great support network. But I think the Molar Clinic in Cork, the midwives there are just amazing. And I think without them, yeah, it would have been more challenging. I suppose they were always on the phone and checking in, you know, if something wasn't right, you know, in the hospital, or if I was dealing with somebody who didn't really understand molar pregnancy or what comes with it, they would always kind of, you know, they'd be ringing up for you and speaking and making sure that you're getting the right care. So from day one, they were just brilliant. And, you know, every week you get your bloods, and obviously hospitals are so busy, and you just really need to know that your HCG is zero or it's coming down. And the girls would always ring or text and say, HCG is this today. And you know, you'd only have got the bloods that morning, and you'd be getting a text in the afternoon, because they'd obviously have you down as, right, Rachel's getting bloods Tuesday, will, you know, and they'll check in with the hospital. And for that, it was just peace of mind, because like normally if you get your bloods taken, like nobody, you know, it's the next time you go and see a doctor. So just having that like reassurance was really good, and they just really understood it, and any questions I had, they'd answer. And then even the second time around, obviously, you know, was really challenging as well, to like it when it came back that time. And you know, Dr. Coulter actually rang me himself and spoke to me, which was really reassuring to know that, you know, all these people, these professionals that really understand it, are really taking an interest in my case and are making sure that I'm getting the right care. And I suppose at that time, there was somebody who had gone through something similar in Ireland, I think maybe a good few years before I did. And they actually reached out to that woman. She lived in Cork, and I remember that we spoke on the phone. We were speaking for an hour, and because it had happened to her, similar story to mine, that had come back, and she had to get the intensive treatment. And I remember just speaking to her, and she was saying, I think her child was three or four at the time, and knowing, right, okay, she came out with that and she had a child. And so it was just those little things was really, you know, good to hear positive stories. So I suppose, yeah, I'd really advise anybody who, you know, is facing a molar pregnancy that they link in straight away with the guys down in Cork, because they're just amazing. And also their website is really good, because if you Google molar pregnancy, you can go down a very, you know, not a nice channel, and you're, you know, you can be very frightening and stuff. And I suppose you really want to hear the facts, information. And yeah, I think they're just brilliant for that, because, you know, in the hospital, when speaking to oncology doctors, they're very much around the oncology side of stuff. And where I think the guys in Cork, they make it more compassionate and understanding about what you're actually going through, which is very supportive.
Yeah, when we spoke with Dr. Coulter, he really described, you know, like what you're describing now, that very patient-centered care and those specialist midwives who are always at the end of the phone for patients, because you really need that support. Because like you said, like there's doctors and nurses who don't know a lot about this. And even talking to your friends, family, who you might oftentimes chat with, they might not know what to say because they haven't heard about it. And then the importance as well of like reaching out to other people and hearing those positive stories of how that other patient was an inspiration to you, that, you know, you were saying, okay, you know, she's okay and she's gotten through it and she has her baby now. And that was kind of inspiring for you. So how reaching out to others for support can really help you, you know, through the journey as well. So, Rachel, is there anything else important that you'd like to highlight today, or what would you say to anybody else who's just been diagnosed with a molar pregnancy?
I think really what I'd like to highlight is just the awareness of it, the awareness of molar pregnancy, particularly in, like, I suppose, in the hospitals with doctors and nurses, because, yeah, they don't, I suppose, in the training, it's probably not really, it's probably something quite small because it really doesn't happen to a lot of people. But I suppose just to have a bit more awareness there, you know, I had to go and sit with other pregnant women who were, you know, having their babies and get my bloods done. And it was just very insensitive and just not really a nice thing to have to do. And I think maybe just, you know, maybe something can be done around that. If somebody does have a molar pregnancy, you know, they can go to a different hospital or their GP could do the bloods or something like that. I just think that part, you know, and the guys in the hospitals are so busy, like, do you know, that kind of way, they're, you know, they're not thinking, oh, this person might have a molar pregnancy. It's not, you know, because they're constantly out the door. So yeah, I suppose just a bit more awareness around that, and just to continue to make sure that the support in the molar clinic is there, I think is crucial to have that piece in Ireland. I think it's amazing that this podcast is happening. I know it would have been something that, you know, at the time when I was in hospital, it would have been amazing to listen to a podcast talking about molar pregnancy. So I think this is really good, because lots of the stuff you look up, it's not Ireland, it's from the UK. It's from America and stuff like that. So, it, you know, there's not a lot in, not a lot of Irish pieces, and I think it's really needed. So I think just to continue bringing awareness around it is really crucial. And then in terms of anybody who's going through it at the moment, I think, you know, it's not going to be forever, although at the time you think that, and you will get through it. You just have to be strong, and you just have to, you know, try, be positive. It's a hard time, but you know, you will get through it, and you will hopefully have your baby at the end of it. And just reach out and get support. Don't be alone in it. You know, lean on your family and friends, and definitely link in with Stacey and Katrina in the Molar Clinic in Cork, because they're absolutely amazing. And yeah, that's kind of, you know, and best of luck with it all. And that's kind of what I would say to anybody who's going through it.
Thanks so much, Rachel. I've learned so much from you, and by you contributing to this podcast, now you're going to be that inspiration to the next person, like that patient was to you that you spoke over the phone. You'll be, you know, that, you know, example, you know, of a positive story with your positive outcome. And congratulations again on your pregnancy, Rachel.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. For more information on gynecological oncology resources, please visit thisisgo.ie. This is a fantastic website for patients and their families that can be tailored to your own personal journey. It is important that all women are aware of the potential symptoms of gynecological cancers. These can include abnormal vaginal bleeding or discharge, feeling full too quickly, bloating or difficulty eating, pelvic pain or pressure, and even abdominal or back pain, a more frequent or urgent need to urinate, and constipation. Finally, itching, burning, pain or tenderness of the vulva, and changes in vulval colour or skin. If you have been experiencing any of these symptoms, please make an appointment to go see your healthcare provider.